You got peace of mind. I did anyway. So thank you for that. Now, any questions or comments?
Yeah.
Okay, even the so-called painful experiences, relative sick, sadhu sick. I remember a Tibetan nun. She was Western, joined the Tibetan order. She was sick with cancer, dying. And I counseled her for a while. And then one day I was working in my monastery down in south of Perth. I got a telephone call from her. And she said, look, I feel I'm going to die soon. Can you come and visit me? I said, I'm busy. Today, I think it's tomorrow I'm going to die. She was perfectly accurate. The next day she passed away. So I dropped everything I was doing, got one of the drivers to stop what they're doing and drive me in about an hour and a half to the hospice. When I got to the hospice, you just can't walk into the ward, to the room, so these people were just so sick they're next to death. You have to check in with the head nurse first of all. So I went to the counter and I said, I've just come to see this Tibetan nun. And she said, I'm terribly sorry, but this nun is not seeing anybody. She's too sick. And I said, look, I've just come for an hour and a half to see her. She said, look, we must respect our patient's wishes. She was really firm with me. But I said, look, she just phoned me up an hour and a half ago. She asked me to come. And this nurse scowled at me. She said, come here. So I followed her. And we went to the door of her room. She said, look. And sure enough, on her door was a big sign. Absolutely no visitors. And the nurse said, see? And I looked, and actually underneath, in small print, was, except Ajahn Brahm. And you know what I did? I told that nurse, see? It was pretty mean, I must admit, but I wanted to get my own back. So she scowled and let me in. But the reason I tell that story was I asked the nun, why did you put that sign up there? And why did you say, except Ajahn Brahm? And she said, because every other visitor who comes in here gets so serious and gets so emotional about my dying. I know I'm dying. I don't need to be asked by my friends, how are you today? I'm sick, I'm dying, stupid. What do you expect? I'm in a hospice. She said, you're the only one who comes in here and treats me as a human being, who tells me jokes and talks to me and not talks to my sickness. And I heard that and I understood something very important. When a person is sick and dying, never talk to the sickness, talk to the person. As you would talk to them, if they're fully healthy, that's how you should talk to them when they're sick. Sickness is only part of the person, and a small part. Even when they're dying, it's only their body dying, not the person. And what if you are ever sick, and you get visited by your friends and relations, it gets really boring and disappointing when people keep asking the same question. How are you today? And so often, you have psychological pressure to lie, to say, I'm feeling a little bit better today, just to cheer up the people who love you, when really you're feeling terrible. Because what's it like if someone visits you, and you tell the truth, I'm feeling awful today? It's not a very nice gift to people who have come all that way to see you. So that's why it's good to talk to the person, not to the sickness. Which is why if a person is really sick, sometimes you see deeper than their sickness. If they're dying, see deeper than their death. It's only the body dying. This is deeper ways of seeing. And you know, if you make peace, you know, as a loved one, as a visitor, you make peace with a person being sick, and you don't get into this serious mode, then what you're actually saying is that sickness and death are part of life. Just like getting married or seeing a child being born. Like going to work. It's just part of things. And we shouldn't give it an importance which it really does not deserve. We amplify it as if it's something terrible and awful. So when you tell somebody, oh, my father just died, they say, I'm sorry. You're not sorry. You don't know my father. Why do you say, I'm sorry? We have these cultural ways of dealing with problems which are sometimes not appropriate. As a Buddhist monk, as someone who sees deeper, you can do different things at different purposes. If somebody really is in pain, I don't go in there and tell jokes. I once went to see a disciple who had a hysterectomy. If you've had that operation, you have a big scar in your stomach, at least they used to have, and it's very painful. And as soon as I came in, she said, Ajahn Brahm, please tell me no jokes. Because it hurts. So on that occasion I was very serious and cool. But a lot of times a bit of humour, if you don't take it seriously, neither does the person dying. They loosen up, they get easy, they get more peaceful. And either they don't die at all, or they die well. But if you go up there and you're, even like funeral services. You know, I've been to so many funeral services where you see these little children come in, maybe five or six. They're full of life and they're playing. Sure that Grandpa has died, but we love Grandpa. Grandpa liked to see us play. And they go playing and laughing. And then they look at their father or their mother and see their mother so sad. I've seen the fear and the confusion in these little children. I say, what's going on? Why are you so hurting? Why have you got so much pain in you? It's a terrible lesson for children to learn. That's why that I try and allow the children to play at funerals. That's their nature. The best way they can pay respect to their grandpa is being happy. That's what their grandpa loved to see in their grandchildren. Play. That's why we want to try and stop some of the bad cultural ways of dealing with some of the problems in our life. Death is part of life. Even young people dying, that simile in my book, Falling Leaves. It's a very meaningful simile which has solved a lot of problems for people who have a child who dies. I know someone very young dying. This monk told this story. He was staying in the north of Thailand in a simple hut in the forest, bamboo and thatch. There was a storm at night. Very violent storm in the jungle. The winds were so powerful that many branches came down and trees also came crashing down. And he was actually so scared for his life he couldn't sleep all night. Because if any tree or even heavy branch fell, it was only thatch, it would go straight through the roof. And if he was underneath, it would break his body, his bones, and maybe kill him. But he was lucky, good karma, that no tree actually fell through. He heard them crashing right next to his hut, but nothing actually broke through. He survived. And when he went out in the early morning, when the storm had gone, he saw all these big trees and branches had just missed his hut. He was really lucky to be alive. But what took his attention was the leaves which had been torn from the tree the night before. Because most of the leaves, as you would expect, were the old brown leaves, which had lived a full life on the tree. But amongst those old withered brown leaves were a few yellow leaves, even a few green leaves. And he noticed one or two, not many, young green leaves which could have only sprouted the day before. They also lay dead on the forest floor as a result of the storm. He looked back up on the trees. As you would expect, most of the leaves remaining alive on the tree were the green leaves. They had survived. But even though some young green leaves were on the floor, dead, still there were some curly old brown leaves still clinging on to the tree, still alive, even though young green leaves had fallen. And he got what we call the insight into the nature of life. When the winds of death go through our communities, they do usually take the old brown leaves. Our uncles and aunties, the old people. But they also take some middle-aged people, the yellow leaves. Some young people, the green leaves. They even take children as well. The leaves which have only sprouted the night before. When the wind blows, some of them also fall. This is the nature of storms, the nature of life and death. When he understood that, he understood nothing has gone wrong that children die or young people get cancer. This is the nature of our life. And we should be just grateful that the people have got so far, 6 years, 7 years of life. Thank you that you've reached so far. Now I let you go in peace. We never get angry or upset at nature. We understand it and work with it rather than against it. Working with the nature of life is a way of peace. Fighting against it, wanting only brown leaves to fall and no green leaves, is going against the nature of things and is a cause for anger and suffering. Look at all the people here today. I see many withered old brown leaves here. Still hanging on. When I know many young people have got cancer and are dying. Is there something gone wrong in life? This is the nature of life. So the Dhamma actually gives us a different vision of things. A vision according to nature, truth. And you know it's truth and nature if it brings peace to your heart. Now I understand. There's nothing gone wrong, nothing to blame. We make peace with it. Sorry, that was a long answer. I should actually answer some more questions. Okay, got one quick one here. I meditate, I feel relaxed to a point and I fall asleep. Is that meditation? If not, how do I overcome falling asleep? Once in the commentaries, the Buddha was going with his attendant, Ananda. As they were walking in the forest, they saw a monk sitting perfectly upright. Perfect posture. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. 2 weeks later, that monk disrobed and got married. Further deeper in the forest, the Buddha saw another monk, nodding this way, nodding that way, half asleep. The Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled. I'm not worried about him. 2 weeks later, he became enlightened with all the psychic powers. When I first read that story, that made no sense to me. How come the monk with the perfect posture, who was really disciplining himself, was going to lose the monkhood and become married? And with a monk who was the slack, lazy, sloppy monk, that he was about to become enlightened. I couldn't figure it out. Later on I understood that first monk was a control freak. Forcing his body to be upright this way and forcing his mind. You never get any peace of mind through willpower, through force. You just get so tight, eventually you get frustrated, angry, depressed, give it up. He had never had any peace in his meditation. He looked perfect on the outside, but inside he was as tight as a ball. The monk who was nodding this way, he was letting go, he was becoming peaceful, he wasn't controlling things. It was only a matter of time when the cause of that sleepiness disappeared and he would be bright and alert, but peaceful enough to see the Dharma become enlightened. Sleepiness goes by itself after a while, but the worst thing is the restlessness. That is the one which we really want to overcome more than anything else. the tightness which makes you crazy. What is the origin of life? Why the Buddha did not tell us? Maybe one day humans can understand it. If the Buddha didn't tell you, why do you ask me? That's a good answer. But anyway, as they say, fall step in where angels or the Buddha feels the tread. The origin of life. Okay, origin of life is craving. Whenever you desire to do things, you become alive, you create the world, and you create yourself, you create the body. So you can see the origin of life is actually craving. And why do we crave? It's just because of stupidity or delusion. We create because we think we're going to get some peace, some happiness, some joy. But the more you do, the more pain you get. You know, the longer you struggle, the more you feel that it's not working. I'm really working hard. I studied hard. I worked hard. Now I really put energy into my life and into my relationships. I even put energy into my meditation. I'm not getting peaceful. Sometimes a little light should go on in there. Maybe there's something wrong with what you're doing. You're struggling too hard. You are, say, trying to hold the water still rather than letting it go, putting it down. You find that craving is the cause of suffering. It creates things. It creates worlds. It creates problems. And you let go of craving. Sure enough, you get peaceful. But as you get peaceful, you fade away and disappear. The ego fades away. Your self disappears. When you disappear completely, that's called enlightenment. That's the origin of life and the end of life. The two ends. The meaning of life. Any problem there? Venerable cried twice at Vulture's Peak. The famous Chinese pilgrim, Xin Zheng, of the Chinese legend Journey to the East, also wept uncontrollably. I personally had a funny sensation feeling there. Why? Why is the place of such significance, especially to those who are practicing the teachings of emptiness in the Prajnaparamita Sutra? Thank you. I don't plan to do these things. It's just, I don't know, the energies of that place. Maybe because it was a great place of meditation. If ever you go on these pilgrimages to India, you've got some very, very powerful places. And that's why basically it's because the devas are still around there. As far as deva lifespans are concerned, even the lowest devas, is in deva spans, it's only about 4 days since the Buddha was there. And obviously still remember. It's just 4 days ago, the Buddha was sitting there getting enlightened and teaching in deva lifespans. So they're still around there in a number. You feel their energy. It's a powerful place. The last pilgrimage I led was this English lady from, she was Devon, I think. No, she was married to this Indian guy who was a main Buddhist. She was actually a Christian before, but I think she's a Buddhist now. She went with her husband on pilgrimage, and I gave her just a little bit of a talk beforehand of what to do, what to expect. And one of the things I said to all the people going on the pilgrimage, these are some very, very powerful places. In some of these places, you'll feel really big emotions coming up. You may even cry. And she came up to ask forgiveness after the trip. Because she told me, when I said that, she said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're being stupid again. There's only ruins, you know, ancient places where the Buddha lived. There's no energy there. You know, I'm a scientist. You know, I'm rational." So she never believed a word of it. But first place we went to, the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya. Now, many of you have been there. She walked into the temple and started weeping uncontrollably. She just couldn't stop herself. And she came up to me afterwards saying, "This is what happened. I'm sorry, you were right." And I tell this story because this was a Westerner who thought it was a completely hocus-pocus, a lot of bunkum, but it happened to her. She felt something so deep and so wonderful, and many people have done that. These are not even Buddhists go there. No Caucasians who have no cultural affinity for Buddhism. But wow, they just weep. And it's just the energy, the inspiration, something just gets way past your rational brain into your emotional heart. This is beautiful. It's not weeping with sadness. It's just weeping with incredible power and inspiration. It's piti sukha. So that happens to me in in the Vultures Peak. I love that place. You go there, wow, getting there again. You know, the other thing which makes me weep when I go to India, there's the most beautiful Buddha statue, which I think is the most beautiful in the world, which is in the museum at Sarnath, outside of Benares. The beautiful Dhammachaka Buddha. I'm sure you've seen it. I'm just looking at it. It's so common, with a big aura around the back. I always knew that was a very beautiful Buddha statue. So the first time I went to India, sort of I went looking for it. I knew it was in a museum, but the museum in India was completely disorganized. There was no maps, no guide. You go in there, and you're just left to yourself. So I went looking for it. All my disciples said, you go and do what you want to do. I'm looking for this Buddha. And I went looking for it this way and that way. And I turned a corner, and I saw it at the end of the corridor. And it just, energy, even now I can feel energy coming up. I started crying. Just bow, 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 many times you possibly can. It's the most beautiful Buddha statue I've ever seen. Second time I went there, I knew exactly where it was. And when we got in the museum, people were looking about all the other exhibits. I said, no, we're going here first. And because I knew what to expect, I thought I was in control. No, it happened again. Went around the corner and saw it. Tears came. It's the most beautiful, inspiring, peaceful Buddha statue I've ever seen. It encapsulates this compassion, this softness, this beauty, this peace. Everything which I feel from a Buddha is right there in that carving. Third time I went there, I was expecting to cry. And when I went around the corner, they were doing renovations. It was covered with a cloth. They were painting and they didn't want any stuff to get over it. And the workman was there. And I thought, oh no. And the workman looked at us. He couldn't understand English. He smiled and took the cloth off for us. Oh, so wonderful. It was like the disappointment made me cry even more, because it was like disappointment and then relief. There it was again. You know, there's nothing wrong with emotions. I know I thought when I was young that you could actually, that an arahant, an enlightened being, had no emotions whatsoever. It was like a robot, like some zombie. And when I saw these enlightened beings in Thailand, and they were just so full of happiness and joy. Now I understand, these are tears of joy. And the emotion of happiness is actually the positive emotion which is supposed to develop amongst you when you develop the path. Is you let go of the negative emotions, the anger, the greed, the pride, the conceit. Those are the ones which goes. For the happy, the joy, the compassion grows stronger and stronger the closer you get to enlightenment. The Buddha was a very happy, beautiful person. So that's actually the goal. Not to be like some zombie who's got no emotions whatsoever. The negative emotions are what goes. Positive emotions stay. So I better carry on, because I'm getting over time. Could you share more of the precept of no killing? Is ordering fish, etc., to be killed considering this Baconist precept? Actually, that is, it's quite clear. If you tell someone to kill, that's like killing yourself if you order it. But if you don't know it's being killed for you, get some fish in a shop, then, of course, it's not considered to be killing. What never seen before animal did the late Ajahn Chah saw whilst having deep samadhi near the lake? Okay, that's called jhanas and enlightenment. It's a simile. The simile of the still forest pool. It's in my book. It's a great simile because that's when Ajahn Chah would actually sit very still when he was wandering around, like I wandered around, find a nice lake so he could bathe, get some water for drinking. In the evening would set his mosquito net about 20 meters away from the lakeside, and sometimes watch the animals come out to play. But they'd only come out to play if he sat absolutely still. If he moved, the animals would know there's a human being there and would never come out. So he was so still, the animals would come and they would not realize a human being was watching them. So they could play naturally. He enjoyed them playing so much. I remember doing that once, watching the birds come to drink. And I noticed I put some water out in the jungle for these birds, and they were very orderly birds. They would actually line up in a queue. It's really cute, one after the other, all different species of birds. And one would go in first to drink and to wash, and when they were finished, another one would come in, all in line. But then, as human nature, so bird nature, a bird jumped the queue. and all the other birds jumped up on him and beat him up. It's funny when you see nature in the wild. It's exactly like human beings, no different. But anyway, when he was really still, that's when the rare animals come out. And this simile was, when you're very still in your mind, then these beautiful meditation experiences come. But if you move, they don't come. So you've got to be still, like say a nature photographer. Not moving so no one knows you're watching. And with that stillness, if you get really still, that's when these beautiful meditation states like jhanas come out. Amazing states of mind, which you don't realize exist. The amount of power and energy and bliss there is literally out of this world. But they only come out when you're absolutely still. If you say, wow, here it comes, they know you said something, and they rush into the bush and never come out again for months. That's why meditation experiences, you have to be that still, just like you would be if there was waiting by a pool and wanting to watch the wild animals. It's a simile. It's one of the most beautiful ones. What is the response? What is the first response from Venerable's mom when Venerable first announced his intention to enter into monkhood? To that great lady of Venerable, was she in grief? Similarly for Venerable's sisters, thank you. I didn't have any sisters, so they didn't cry. My father never said anything either about me becoming a monk, because he had already died a few years earlier. But my mother, she was very happy I was becoming a monk, because I was a very responsible young man. I got a good degree, I'd always done the right thing, being very responsible and good and kind. She trusted me. She said, I'm very happy you're a monk. The only thing I don't like is you're becoming a monk so far away. Even if I'd, you know, joined some corporation and they sent me to head office in Bangkok, she would have been similarly upset. Not because what I was doing, but simply the case, the mother likes to be close to the children. But you have to do that sometimes. You know, children go to university in England or Australia or America. Now you let them go because you know it's good for them. You don't like them going. You're separated from your kids. You just love them to be around. So I always made sure I couldn't cause no phone calls, but it was all right to my mother. And she was very, very happy. And eventually she was really proud of me being a monk. Now the first time I went home to visit her, the Saturday morning was when she did her shopping for the week. And so I said, can I come with you? I can maybe help you carry your bags. I've come here to see you. So I went with her when we went shopping, where she goes every Saturday in these small, what they call the high streets, not the big shopping malls, where she'd see all her friends. And first of all, I thought she'd be embarrassed by having a monk standing next to her in his funny clothes. I thought, you know, she would walk maybe, you know, a meter in front or a meter behind. I'm not with this strange-looking guy. But no, she walked right beside me. And then when we got to the place where we have the... Because they're very narrow roads in London, they have like railings to protect the pedestrians from the cars in the middle of the road. And usually, on those railings, that's where you leave the prams and the dogs. And I thought that's where she'd leave me. While she goes into the shops. No, she didn't. She dragged me into the shop. And the first shop she went into, where she goes regularly, every week, she said to the shopkeeper, this is my son, the Buddhist monk. I realized from that my mother was proud of me. She wasn't at all embarrassed. That was such a wonderful feeling. And I understand now that that's how mothers feel. Even if your son or your daughter's a bank robber, you say, he's the best bank robber in the whole of Malaysia. A mother's love for their children is something else. And I think you women will understand that, but obviously she's very proud of that. I wasn't a bank robber, I was a very good man. How does one have a relationship with a person who's verbally abusive and egotistical? Even in public in front of kids, not improved despite life-threatening experiences, throat cancer and stroke, psychologically manipulative. Please do not say, you should have said that first of all. And not financially responsible, thank you very much. With repeated sexual misconduct as well. Gee, why did you choose that person in the first place? please choose your relationships well. So, you know, check them out first of all. Don't just marry someone because they've got lots of money or because they look really hot. You know, because that doesn't last very long. You're marrying a person, not a body. You're not marrying a bank account. So when you realize what you're marrying, you can choose somebody who is a good character. However, if you have got that person as a partner, and you really want to try working it out, there are ways of training a husband or a wife. I didn't actually say a husband. There are ways of training them, but it takes a lot of effort. And sometimes you have to find out, why are they sort of in such a bad mood? One of the best ways is take them to the Buddhist Gem Fellowship. Teach them some meditation. We'll sort them out. But that's a big question, but actually a bit of meditation does really help them. Martial arts involves aggression, and meditation seems to involve loving kindness. Can the two coexist? Sometimes practicing martial arts seems to involve a mindset that is contrary to harmlessness. Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. Again, I never did martial arts, so I don't know too much about it, but I do know that people start martial arts with aggression, but eventually, if you go to the higher stages, it's more sort of non-violent and more like a mental and physical training. You're not meant to harm anyone. If you have to harm someone, that shows you you're not really skillful enough. I know in Thailand, the military in Thailand used to have, this is 200, 300 years ago, that they used to meet their adversaries in battle, and they used to make the most noise they could, and the army which made the most noise would win, and the other one would just concede. They never used to actually go into battle. It was all like show and huff and puff. And if you had to go into battle, the general was considered to be a failure, because they wanted to have a bit of non-violence. However, that stopped these days. But if you do have aggression, I don't think you can really go too far in martial arts. I think in the real martial arts. I don't know, see what martial arts you're doing, see what type of teacher you have. And maybe you don't want to do it. Maybe you can just go to the gym and become fit and come here to train the mind. So it's up to you. How do you live with people that's full of anger? This is a person with a heart of gold, but yet a hot temper person that always overly dominates others. If they've got a heart of gold, please tell them what a beautiful heart of gold they have. And let them value their heart of gold so much they never want to express the other part of them, of anger and domination. Because they really have got a beautiful heart inside. They've got a seed which can grow. If that seed is watered and grows enough, then it will dominate their other part of the character, the anger, and they will sort of just let go. They have to be less controlling. They say domination and anger, they always go together. The hot temper becomes when you get frustrated, when you try and control things, but it doesn't work out anymore. You get frustrated and angry. So that's where we have to just let things go. Is it true that the only son of the second richest man in Malaysia, and landowner of the Twin Towers, and the owner of Astro and Maxis, renounced under Venerable's great teacher, the late Ajahn Chah? Is it okay for us to know the reasons for the multi-billionaire in waiting to decide so? And if so, what is all the reasons? Thank you. Yeah, that's true. And I know him very well. He's a great fan. He spent a year at my monastery over in Perth, and still met him a couple of weeks ago. And he said he never got much meaning in life from wealth. He's a very skillful person, and one of the things he's got, knows many languages. He went over to Russia and quickly learnt Russian and worked for the BBC in Russia for a while. And one of the things, he can do a perfect imitation of me. And all the other senior monks, he's got this ability to imitate people's voice and mannerisms. So the next time if you see him, ask him, can you impersonate Ajahn Brahm? And it's amazing, he's got this ability that if you close your eyes, you think that's Ajahn Brahm speaking. So that's one of the abilities he's got. And so he plays around that with the lesser monks, the smaller monks, but he refuses to do it as me. I say, come and impersonate me, and he refuses to do so. I thought it would be very funny to hear what I sound like. But he did that because he gets much more happiness and peace being a Buddhist monk, much more meaning in life. And this is great because it's people who have the opportunity for wealth. You know, if he's a son of a multi-billionaire, you know, basically that many women would look at him and say, wow, he's a catch. Because, you know, he's young, he's good looking, and he's very skilled at what degrees he's got, and very wealthy. Wow, yeah, he must, you know, we want him. So he could have almost any girl he wanted. He didn't have to work, go wherever he wants. Isn't it wonderful that there's a person who's not just renounced a small amount, but renounced a lot, just like the Buddha renounced, you know, a kingship. And those are people who just really make you think, why did he do that? He obviously, he didn't do that through force. He's been a monk for about 11 years now, I think. He could leave at any time, but he doesn't want to. Because he gets more peace and happiness from living a simple life of meditation and service to others than from anything else. He has a choice, and he chose simplicity more than wealth. That's why it's inspiring. I didn't have wealth, but I had a good career in front of me, a good degree, a good life. But no, I prefer being a monk as well. There's another fellow who lives up in Thailand still. About 30 years ago, his parents, very wealthy, came to Thailand with a blank check for $1 million US. They would give it to their son if you would disrobe. No questions asked, just $1 million US. And that was a time when $1 million was worth something. You know, 30 years ago. I don't know what inflation is, but that, how much would that be worth now? Any economists here? $1 million these days? Is it $30 million or $20 million? It's a lot of money. And it was just, no questions asked, if you leave the robes now, you can have $1 million. No. I'm still a monk today. There's a few people like that, which actually shows that this being a monk renouncing, there must be something in this when it's worth more than $1 million. So, peace of mind is worth more than all the money in the world. Peace is priceless, which is why if you really understand the peace and happiness of deep meditation, of making peace with whatever you have to do in life, you find that no amount of money will ever make you leave. We make money to find peace. We don't give up peace to have money. And there we go. What a wonderful place to end this Dharma enrichment camp. Not enrichment, but giving up your worldly riches to have Dharma riches. You got a question?
Clarification. What would you say to a person who is commonly ill, like the Tibetan nun who wants to see? What you share?
I told her all my latest jokes. Because that's what she wanted. She was dealing with her pain and difficulty. But what she really craved was to be related to as a person rather than somebody dying. And that really meant something to me. That was her choice. Please tell me the jokes. You're the only one who actually doesn't talk to my sickness, but talks to me. There's something more than my sickness. I am a person who is dying, not dying, and the person has disappeared. It's always really important. That's why if you see someone disabled, there's a person inside that autistic being. In that Down syndrome child, you can see just the inability to communicate, but underneath that is a person, a being in there. Please, please recognize and talk to the person. Don't talk to the sickness. Okay, I think that's enough. Otherwise, I get in trouble and you'll get in trouble for going over time. Because if you go over time, it's 5 o'clock. Do we have to actually pay extra money?